My name is Matt Murphy. I'm the tour program supervisor here at Eastern State Penitentiary Historic Site, and I'm going to be your tour guide.
We travel for business. We travel for pleasure. We travel to expand our minds, whether it's one state over or halfway around the globe. If the world's a book, why only read one page? I'm Elizabeth Hill, and you're listening to a WAMC Northeast Public Radio production. This is Postcards from the Road.
And of course, most notably, Al Capone got his tonsils out. Why don't we step into some cells?
No goody.
Eastern State Penitentiary is arguably one of the most important penitentiaries ever built, and the very first of its kind here in America. Originally built about a mile and a half outside of Philadelphia proper, on an old cherry orchard, by the mid-1800s it was encased in the newly constructed Philadelphia suburbs. Eastern State was in its 15th decade of operation by the time it was closed, and situated in the up-and-coming neighborhood of Fairmount. Patrick Garrett of WAMC's Listen with the Lights On and I took a road trip to Philadelphia to join the 250,000 tourists that flock to Eastern State every year. We met with Matt Murphy, the tour program supervisor of Eastern State, to learn the ins and outs of this national historic landmark.
Our twofold goals is to interpret the history of the building, but also connect it to what's going on today in the world of criminal justice.
In 1971, Eastern State closed its doors after 142 years of operation. Along with increased public pressure from the community around the prison, the facility itself was fading into obscurity in the changing criminal justice system, and was no match to the modern prisons being built across the country. The complex remained abandoned for 20 years, until the city of Philadelphia bought the 10-acre property from the state of Pennsylvania and placed it on the auction block, taking bids. When a group of historians and conservationists banded together to form the Eastern State Task Force.
And their job was to figure out a way to turn this into some kind of cultural institution and interpret its history for the public. Not everyone thought this was really a smart idea, and some people thought that there wouldn't be any interest.
However, much to the chagrin of those who wanted it to fail, Eastern State opened its doors as a museum in 1994. Join Patrick Garrett and myself, with Matt Murphy, on a tour of Eastern State Penitentiary. This is Episode 9, If Walls Could Talk.
We're going to go into cell block 1 right over here. So you might see a lot of clutter around the site, benches and these corrugated tin booths. They're actually part of Terror Behind the Walls.
Oh, all right.
So it's a busy time of year. Terror Behind the Walls is our annual haunted house, and it supports the museum. So we're about to walk into the front door of cell block 1. The very first prisoner that entered Eastern State in October of 1829 was Charles Williams. He was a 18-year-old man or a boy, however you want to look at it. He was convicted of burglary. He had stolen a golden watch. He would be sentenced to 2 years. He'd be Eastern State prisoner number one.
And was the whole structure built before prisoners started coming in, or was it built cell block by cell block?
The latter. So when the prison first opened in 1829, all that was erected was the exterior walls, the front gate structure, the central rotunda, and cell blocks 1 and 2. The prison wouldn't be done on its original design until 1836. It took about 14 years to build the place. Today there's about 15 cell blocks, so construction would continue in bursts throughout the history. The outside of the building was designed to have this intimidating Gothic castle-like feel. It was supposed to be ominous and imposing. It was supposed to be a deterrent. The man who designed this place was an architect named John Havlin, and he's worried about the people that have not yet come to prison when he builds the facade. But on the inside, if you look around, the cell blocks at Eastern State have a different feel. They're supposed to be reminiscent of a Gothic cathedral. Each cell block has high barrel arch ceilings. There's nearly 1,000 skylights in the whole structure. John Havlin thinks that the way a building looks will change the way people behave while they're inside of it. So John Havlin is tasked with designing the world's first true penitentiary. And so what that means is he's building a structure designed to inspire regret. How you do that is not something that everybody agrees on or really knows how to do.
Is that what makes it different from a prison?
Absolutely. So today we sometimes use the word penitentiary, and it's kind of a byword for prisons. But back in the early 19th century, it was a different kind of institution. It was an institution focused on reform, rehabilitation. That's another reason Eastern State's such a noteworthy building. It really kind of changes the mission of prisons. Incarceration is believed to be able to make someone less likely to break the law. That wasn't always the case. Prisons before Eastern State, prisons of the 18th and early 19th century, were usually rowdy, overcrowded, communal-style holding tanks. Men, women, adults, children, violent criminals and nonviolent criminals housed together, somewhat indiscriminately. Conditions were usually poor, and so prison reformers are also concerned with prisons as being like schools for criminal vice. The idea is that someone might come in, maybe a pickpocket, and leave a murderer. Or they might be victimized. They might go through trauma while they're incarcerated. So they want to fix all of these problems, and they're going to do it by building what they think will be the perfect prison, and that ends up being Eastern State. The main tool they're going to use to get all this done is solitary confinement. The founders of Eastern State established a system known as the Pennsylvania system. The Pennsylvania system is also known as the separate system. And in this system, all prisoners were kept in solitary confinement for the duration of their stay here. It didn't matter what they were here for. They did not discriminate in that way. The idea was, you cast a person alone in isolation, and you take away their negative influences, and they'll be forced to think, reflect, and seek penitence.
But that isn't always the case.
But that's not always the case, as history would prove. When the rubber hit the road, the realities of the penitentiary collided with the daily operation of a building with people inside of it that didn't want to be there. Solitary confinement is really hard to maintain on a massive scale like this, and that was a hard lesson the Eastern State's founders would learn. Detractors of Eastern State, critics, would slam it as cruel and wrong. They'd say it was bad for the health of the prisoners, both physical and mental. Charles Dickens visits the prison in 1842. He's on his first tour of the United States. He's so struck by the prison that he writes a whole chapter in his book, American Notes. And he describes the system as rigid, strict, and hopeless solitary confinement. So Eastern State is highly controversial. There's a lot of debate, a lot of argument about it.
And how long was the solitary confinement period in the prison? When did they switch over to allowing other prisoners to room together or to interact together?
Solitary confinement as an institutional practice in its purest form did not last that long. Philadelphia's population was growing explosively in the 19th century, maybe even doubling every 20 years. And that meant that there was more crime, there was more criminals, there's more prisoners, but not necessarily more prisons. And so they came to Eastern State. And they were quickly overwhelmed. We think there was more prisoners in cell here by as early as the 1860s. And it really never gets any better. It only gets worse. The prison will try to build new cell blocks starting in the 1870s, but they can't get ahead of it. And so by the turn of the century, there's probably twice as many prisoners as there are cells here. And 1913, the state of Pennsylvania, the legislature, will end separate confinement as the law of the land. So that was really just the official end of it, but it was really degrading rapidly before that.
However, solitary confinement is still prevalent in New York State as a form of punishment within the prison system. 5 days after our tour at Eastern State, New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo's office declared new regulations regarding oversight of solitary confinement in local jails. Under these new guidelines, jails are required to provide individuals in solitary confinement with 4 hours outside their cell. Jails will also have to report any decision that places an individual in solitary for more than 1 month. The Democratic governor stated, quote, "Amid public reports of misuse and abuse of solitary confinement, these new standards will inject much-needed uniformity, accountability, and transparency. They will help root out unacceptable behavior and build upon landmark reforms put into place at state prisons, creating a consistent level of quality and fairness at all facilities across New York, end quote. The State Commission of Correction also commented on the regulations. Quote, while disciplinary or administrative segregation may be necessary to maintain the safety of inmates, staff, and public, implementation of these measures should be the exception, not the rule. I sat listening to this story thinking about a prisoner's life in the early days of Eastern State's operation.
A prisoner's life was pretty simple here. They lived 23 hours a day in their cell in solitary confinement. Their break from their cell was a half an hour in the morning and in the afternoon in what was called a solitary exercise yard. This is a very unusual and elaborate and expensive part of the original building. Each cell had a yard attached to it. It was kind of like a second cell, but it didn't have a roof. It was 18 feet long, 8 feet wide, and a prisoner was supposed to get their fresh air and sunlight, and the administration thought that's how they would endure. This would keep them healthy and maybe happy at their time here. Their cells were spartanly furnished. The cells were pretty large for the standards of the day, but a cornhusk mattress, a workstation, a toilet, and a sink. Eastern State is arguably the first large-scale public structure in the U.S. to have indoor heating, running water, and flush toilets. So it was a very modern building in that way, and that was part of precluding disease from spreading. A prisoner was expected to work while they were here. If they did not know a trade, like, they would be taught one. Shoemaking and weaving were two very common trades here. Guards would be their instructors, and that is often how a guard got their job. They had a skilled trade background, and they could teach the prisoners. Prisoners could also meet with a moral instructor or a religious instructor of their choosing. Again, here's that moralistic thinking. The thought process is they've made bad choices. Let's help this person make good choices, seek a better path. Charles Williams, the first prisoner, learned to make shoes. He learned to read by reading the scripture, and everyone had very high hopes for Charles. Charles would be the first prisoner. He'd also come up again in the 300 series. He would come back. He would be a recidivist, is what we would say today. So even Charles Williams, who nominally would have had all the administration's attention as much as they could give, he would come back.
So why don't we step into some cells?
No goody. Here we go.
So the cells were large for the day. They might even be considered large by some prison system standards today. The architect knew that prisoners were going to be spending a lot of time in these cells. They're going to be laboring in these cells, so they probably need a little elbow room. The cells have a high arched ceiling with a skylight. There was no electricity here for about 60 years, so the building was totally daylit. Now the building was designed, the cells were designed to be bright, fresh, ventilated. In reality, they were often the opposite. They were quite dark, dank, and foul. They had running water, they had toilets, they had heating. Very novel, very innovative, but extremely crude by our standards today. It was very cold here in the winter, and very hot here in the summer. It still is.
Yeah.
It still is. But I think there's something chilling about stepping into the cells here. I always try to imagine what it would have been like, really try to imagine. Prison had a strict silent code. Prisoners were not allowed to talk to each other, make noise, sing, whistle. So it was truly a lonely experience. So we're standing in the central rotunda, or center. Center is a big part of why this building is a museum, actually. Eastern State was built on what was called the radial plan. And the idea was there was a central hub, a surveillance hub for a guard, and then the original seven cell blocks would radiate out, sort of like the spokes of a wheel, from this rotunda. And so a guard in the middle of this rotunda could basically just turn around 360 degrees and peer down the long cell blocks. You can see it all from here. And so before, like, surveillance monitors or cameras, this was about as good as prison security could get. And so visiting prison architects from all over the world would be inspired by Eastern State and the attractiveness of its design. And they build their own prisons. And so the radio plan spreads all over the world. There's about 300 prisons that are inspired by Eastern State's radio design. We have another tour guide here. His name's Ted. And Ted kind of encapsulated Eastern State for me in a brief question. You know, he's like, I once heard him asking a visitor, did you ever have a really big plan that you had high hopes for that really just never quite got off the launch pad? And that just resonated with me. That's like Eastern State. So the prison gets halfway through being built. The building commissioners panic because they're already overcrowded with prisoners. There's already too many people here. And so they ask John Haviland to design bigger cell blocks with what's left. So cell blocks 4 through 7 end up becoming bigger structures. And they make some sacrifices. Some of the niceties of the building go out the window. With the second story cell block, prisoners upstairs were unable to go into a solitary exercise yard. They probably spent too much time indoors. Prisoners on the first floor didn't get a skylight, that nice skylight we saw in the cell, and it was probably darker and danker and nastier in those cells. Guards in center really couldn't see the second tier as well either, but those are some of the sacrifices they had to make just to house people. And that would continue to plague Eastern State throughout its history. So after 1913, when the Pennsylvania legislature ends solitary confinement, things rapidly change here at Eastern State. It becomes a congregate prison, more like what prisons are like today. Prisoners were allowed to have cellmates. They worked together, they ate together, they worshiped together. So we're out on the baseball field, the football field. Basically, it was the largest rec yard that the prison would get. Prisoners were never intended to be out in the open spaces between the cell blocks, but things changed and the priorities had to be kind of reordered. And with a booming prison population, getting people outdoors and getting them some fresh air, exercise, blowing off some steam became a very important priority, a very high priority. In the 1920s and 30s, the population was at its peak. There were over 1,800 prisoners here at one point in 1931. And so instead of one person in a cell, that meant 3 or 4, 5, maybe even 6 people in some cells in extreme cases. So getting out was important. Lack of space was one of the most serious problems they had here. There was just not enough place for people to go. You can see a baseball backstop with some old goalposts for kicking an extra point. And then on top of the 30-foot stone wall, there was added a chain-link fence to swat home run balls back. So apparently it was a serious nuisance. They would hit hundreds out of here. Any lefty would knock one out of here. There's a lot of cute anecdotes about the warden going to pay bills for broken windows. But there was also a more serious, more real nuisance.
The Phillies.
We know that balls would come back over the wall. And sometimes they'd be filled with contraband, things like heroin. So the prison had a serious drug problem in the 1920s and 30s. There was the gang, the Four Horsemen, made this drug trade flourish. And there's an investigation in 1923. And the investigators believe that as much as 500 of the 1,700 prisoners in the walls might be addicted to some form of opioid, heroin, morphine.
Those statistics might not be as startling, as opiates are still a huge problem, not just in the prison system, but in the whole country. Last week, President Donald Trump declared a public health emergency to deal with the opioid crisis. America is facing one of the worst drug epidemics in history. President Trump stated that, quote, "It's just been so long in the making, addressing it will require all of our effort." On Friday, Massachusetts announced its plan to tackle opioids in legislation that calls for the biggest overhaul of the state's criminal justice system in decades. The proposed legislation still faces many obstacles, but some of the issues it attempts to tackle include the elimination of most mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenders, higher penalties for trafficking fentanyl, and provisions on how solitary confinement is used in state prisons, among others. Senate leaders packaged the legislation as an attempt to provide alternatives to incarceration and reduce recidivism. However, a majority of the state's district attorneys wrote to the Senate leaders, arguing it largely ignores the victims of crime and puts at risk the progresses and incomparable success of the state's approach to public safety and criminal justice for the last 20 years. Attacking the opioid crisis head-on has become a priority for many states, like Massachusetts. It has also helped to highlight concerns facing the current prison population and the need to reevaluate how we look at criminal punishment within the U.S.
Booming prison population, so it made life difficult here at Eastern State, makes life difficult in prisons today, both for prisoners and the administration. So we decided as a museum to put in a new exhibit in 2014. It was called The Big Graph, and this was a big major shift for us, talking more with our visitors about issues in criminal justice today.
As you can imagine, standing in the middle of a baseball field in Philadelphia in October, it's a little windy. But Matt shared with us some staggering statistics. Between 1970 and 2010, we experienced a 600% growth in the rate of incarceration, making the United States world leader. And it costs about $80 billion to do it.
There's a vested public interest in these questions. You know, for the most part, these are funded by tax dollar. So I think that everybody should be interested in these issues. They speak volumes about us, how we come off to the international community. All along the 16-foot high facade of the graph are basically every other country in the world and their rates of incarceration compared to the United States. And so I think it shocks a lot of our visitors to see that the United States is at the very tippy top. So as of 2012, 730 out of 100,000 Americans were incarcerated, and that's the highest rate in the world. You can see it's split between death penalty states and non-death penalty states. So a lot of people ask us if other countries, you know, keep their rates down via the death penalty. And it just doesn't seem like necessarily there's a correlation. China, you know, one of the world's leaders in performing capital punishment, is nearly the same rate of incarceration as, say, Canada, who has been an abolitionist state for a while.
Yeah, that's why I like to see the hospital.
Ooh.
It's a sensitive space, so it's done by guided tour only.
Okay.
Twice an hour. It just opened up last spring, though, so it's been closed for about 47 years, so for quite a while. We consider Eastern State a stabilized ruin, and that means that anywhere a visitor goes is safe for them to enter, but there isn't really a plan to restore the building, make it look the way it looked at one specific period in its history. We do that very sparsely. There's multiple reasons. One, it's just a massive, incredible task. Two, it's part of the mystique of the building. People love the rust and the patina and the decay. And in a way, it's as an interpreter of a historical building, it does a huge favor. There's all these different layers of histories exposed to us. So the prison shows its 1830 face just as well as it shows its 1968 face.
I like how you can see the old wooden structure.
Yeah, you know, our conservators did something pretty innovative. If you come over here, you can see the wood lathing a little bit more. So our conservators will sometimes take historic fabric like this old wood from the 19th century, and they'll take it off site to treat it so it doesn't rot or, you know, desiccate or whatever. It looked like it was kind of a daunting task, taking all these off piece by piece, delicately enough that they wouldn't snap them. So they ended up doing something kind of interesting. They kind of ended up rolling them into a bundle, kind of like a bedroll almost, and taking it off that way. And then they just kept carrying it under their arm like a bundle. They treated it off-site, brought it back, and then unrolled it and nailed it back on. Really cool. They actually took time-lapse photography of it. It was so innovative. I think it really got fellow conservators really like hot and bothered. but taking care of the building is a full-time job. Our CEO, Sally Elk, is a conservator by trade, and her passion is the building and making sure it stays around forever. So the prison did not have a formal hospital facility for nearly 50 years. There was a small infirmary in the front gate structure, but it was totally inadequate for the task it faced. By the 1870s, tuberculosis was one of the top killers throughout the country. And so what was happening was more people were bringing the disease into the prison with them upon their admission. And at the same time, the system of solitary confinement was eroding, and prisoners were spending a lot more time with each other, talking to each other, sharing things, touching things, coughing on each other. So it was in the air, and it really just spiraled out of control from there. So you can think of this end of the cell block almost like quarantine. A prisoner would be suspected of a disease or confirmed, and they'd be sent down to quarantine to a solarium cell maybe.
Why is it called solarium?
Solarium sun, like a sunroom, basically. So the idea was bring as much as the good stuff from outside, the vitamin D. Victorian America went through great lengths to find effective treatment for the disease. Now, putting someone in like a sunroom cell might seem bizarre to us today, but this would be very akin to something that, say, a wealthy Philadelphian might pay out the nose for. Whitehaven was Pennsylvania's number one sanitarium, a hospital for the treatment of long-term diseases. And so they would pay big bucks to take a train up to the Poconos and sit out on a lodge balcony wrapped in blankets for hours a day and take long horseback rides and eat special diets. So it was, as old-fashioned as it might seem to a visitor today, the medical care here usually reflected patterns on the outside. And eventually the hospital would become reminiscent of a modern hospital. We'll see a lot of facilities that you would recognize today. So that wrapping is a hard steel door. In the 1920s, several of the quarantine cells were actually converted into psychiatric observation cells. And so they have a thick steel door with a glass observation window. It's muffling sound, hard to break through, but guards and doctors could keep an eye on the prisoners here. So if someone was having a mental health crisis, they'd probably be sent down here. Going into the 20th century, the hospital would be updated, modernized, and fitted with pretty much everything a small hospital would need. The lab would be used to check for contagious diseases. It would be used to cook up vaccines. The prison had a pretty serious problem with sexually transmitted diseases in the 20th century, what the prison called social diseases. We know that in 1919, they even called the State Board of Health in to institute a massive treatment course for the prisoners here. Probably the most impressive feature of the hospital was a fully functional operating room installed in 1910. The medical staff here could perform a wide variety of procedures: wound suturing, appendectomy, joint surgery, optic surgery, plastic surgery. One of the very few benefits this facility ever garnered from being in the middle of an urban environment was that Philadelphia is a great medical city. It's always been a great medical city, and they could usually borrow from the professionals in the community. We know that by the 1920s, there was up to 30 physicians consulting here at once, and a lot of them came in and did their work pro bono. So there wasn't a lot they couldn't handle. We know by the 1960s that there's up to 300 procedures performed in here a year, so it was well used. And of course, most notably, Al Capone got his tonsils out while he was here. So had a little surgery, recovered in the hospital before going back to general population. A newspaper reporter noted that he was reading a biography of Napoleon Bonaparte. So, without argument, Eastern State's most famous prisoner was Al Capone. Al Capone was a famous gangster from Chicago. He was a bootlegger during Prohibition, arguably one of the most successful at it. A very famous man, a very wealthy man, a very powerful man. And he would be incarcerated for the very first time, convicted of a crime, at Eastern State in the spring of 1929. Now, he wasn't from Philadelphia, and he was actually just kind of traveling through town when he got caught by Philadelphia police officers. He was traveling from Atlantic City. He stopped in Philadelphia to catch a connecting train that would take him to Chicago. Missed his train, decides to go see a movie to kill time, and somehow Philadelphia detectives are alerted to his presence in the city. And they stop him on his way outside of the theater, frisk him, and find an unlicensed .38 caliber revolver. And this was sort of a black and white crime, the sort of thing that would follow Capone throughout his life. Do you have a gun on you? Yes. Do you have a permit? No. So even the best gangland lawyer couldn't really get Capone out of this. He would be arraigned and tried immediately, and would end up receiving the maximum sentence of 1 year.
A large group of tourists walk by as Matt continues to explain. While Capone is incarcerated, an article is published in the Philadelphia Public Ledger. The journalist claims to have met with Capone and gotten a quote, "very comfortable." And his cell is described as luxurious. There's no photographic evidence to corroborate. However, Eastern State used the article to recreate Capone's cell for visitors.
Now, Capone will be released from Eastern State in 1930, and the administration feels that Capone is such a celebrity that they need to do something of a fake release, kind of a bait and switch. They'll transfer Capone to Graterford Penitentiary, 35 miles northwest of Philadelphia, and release him to his family in the middle of the night. And so the crowd was so eager to see Capone, they stuck around for hours. Even when the warden came out and said, "No, you've been had. He's not here. He's already released," they still stuck around. So he was a big fish. And then Capone would, only be free for a little bit, only about a year and a half, before being arrested again by the federal government for tax evasion, which would send him to Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, Alcatraz, Terminal Island, and even a little bit at Lewisburg.
We concluded our tour with a special treat.
Attention all staff, letting you know that Matt is going up to the guard tower.
Although this element is closed to the public, we were able to get a bird's eye view of the grounds and the Philadelphia skyline. We took in one last look before night fell, and we entered Terror Behind the Wall. I would like to give a very special shout-out to Matt Murphy and everyone down at Eastern State Penitentiary for hosting us earlier this month, where we were quite literally on the road for Postcards from the Road. If you'd like to learn more about Eastern State's Halloween-themed fundraiser, Terror Behind the Walls, head on over to WAMC's podcast, Listen with the Lights On, where Patrick Garrett and Jessica Blaustein Marshall take you through this 6-stage haunted house and the intricacies that go into planning an event so huge. Postcards from the Road is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Our theme music is Cherry Blossom Wonders by Kevin MacLeod. And as always, if you like what you hear, subscribe on your audio app of choice. Visit WAMCpodcasts.org for more information.